drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. The Mars Room is a book that probes into the meaning of punishment and the American prison system. It tells the story of a woman serving two life sentences for killing her stalker, and it's the product of years of research and close collaboration with Americans who have themselves served time. Rachel Kushner is the author, and she joins us in the drawing room. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What compelled you to explore the American prison system?
I think of it more as a book about California than a book about the prison system, although, of course, the main character, the narrator, Romy Hall, does end up in prison serving two life sentences. But many parts of the book are about her earlier life in San Francisco, and there are other characters like the teacher Gordon Hauser, who goes in and out of the prison and lives in the Central Valley. And the way the state is geographically structured is, as a Californian, is interesting to me. Most people who go to prison in California are from the metropolitan, larger urban area of Los Angeles, where I live. They are sent to prisons that are in a quite rural area in the heart of industrial farming. Very few people live there. It's mechanized agriculture. They are people who are sent very far from where they're from into an environment that's alien to them. And I guess I've always been aware of how society is structured, and it includes this, if you will, carceral landscape. And once you start to see the evidence of that carceral landscape in the broader society, there are aspects of it that are subtle and almost invisible, but when you've learned to see them, it becomes very hard to unsee them. Some I saw at a younger age because I grew up with some people who went to prison. So that sort of marks your interest in the subject for better or worse.
Let's talk about that experience growing up with people that went to prison. When did that happen, and how much did it change the way you thought about the world around you?
Well, I was aware of prison since I was little because my parents had friends who'd been in and out of prison. But I had a particular friend in high school who ended up serving a very long sentence and taking on a kind of identity that was totally manufactured by the social environment of prison. And when you take on that identity, to me, it seemed like a life sentence. Like, you decide that you're going to be good at prison at the expense of ever being good at living in the so-called free world. And that person's no longer alive. But when he was, when I knew him in high school, he, like many of my friends, was somebody who I think I thought of, whether consciously or not, as free to quote-unquote destroy himself, because he didn't have a duty to make a contribution or be a certain kind of person, didn't come from that tradition, but was incredibly brilliant and very, very funny, and was willing to humiliate people in positions of authority in order to entertain his friends. And I think that there's a kind of contradiction of being willing to sacrifice everything in order to win, like willing to lose in order to win against somebody like a prison warden or a police officer, that has always interested me because it's a dynamic I'm familiar with from my social life as a teenager.
Women's correctional facilities.
Yeah.
Now that's at the center of your book. Is there a gendered nature to incarceration?
That is a great question. And I believe now, yes, there is. I don't like to think in terms of like broad brush reductions when I'm immersed in the world and being a writer. But now, having written the book and done some of these interviews a few times, it's occurred to me that there is a pretty tidy demarcation between what are called men's facilities and what are called women's. And I've spent a lot of time at both. At the men's facilities, the men are basically treated like monsters. At the women's facilities, the women are basically treated like babies. So in the first case, it's a kind of animalization of the human, an otherization. And then in the case of the women, it's this infantilizing. The women are perceived as whiny and manipulative and obsessed with psychology, and they want to argue everything, and they need to be told why the rule is the way it is. And they're seen as having really no autonomy or dignity. The men are respected by the guards because they're seen as sort of, you know, people who are capable of great violence.
That's really fascinating. That's just, I'm sorry, I'm floored by that. So the men are respected because they're afraid of them.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to, you know, overgeneralize, but there is a dynamic, particularly in California, where like men's prisons are racially divided, quite extremely so, and the women's really aren't. And part of those racial divisions in men's prison has to do with a culture that is in part inculcated by the administration and the guards. And so there's betting that goes on in terms of, you know, race riots and who's going to win a fight. And they'll let somebody on the yard who they know is going to instigate a problem with somebody else. And guards won't go out there and mediate because they've actually put money on who's going to win. I mean, I've seen things like this, and it's not a pleasant world to expose yourself to, but I felt like I had the opportunity to see a lot of that world and was willing to keep my eyes open and observe it, even if it meant that I had to take in a lot of disturbing imagery and material. But, you know, there's a part of you that stays the same regardless of what you've been exposed to, and also its reality in California. It's something to do with the way the society is structured, that these prisons are there, but they're kept totally out of view.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis. Author Rachel Kushner is my guest in the drawing room, and we're talking about the Mars Room. It's an interesting point you make that this book is about California, but it's a side of California I don't think is depicted in fiction enough or in the mainstream. Was that part of your purpose here too, to tell that different story of a place that I think around the world we're quite familiar with?
Well, not so much, only because I don't, like, I'm not that, maybe calculating is the wrong word.
Or deliberate.
I don't think like, oh, this is something that I want readers to know about or, you know, turn their minds to because it doesn't have enough representation in fiction or anything like that. I had finished my previous novel, which largely takes place during the 1970s, and thought, well, what is a contemporary novel for me? I mean, there's a lot of primacy that's placed artistically on the idea of writing a contemporary novel and being a kind of, you know, a mirror that's reflecting the times. And for me, a contemporary novel is not just a book that is furnished with the accoutrements of the present, but needs to have a kind of idea in it of where we are historically, what shape our historical drift has settled into. And so this topic had been of interest to me for, I guess, you know, a long time, and I think it has to do with the contemporary in California. I mean, it may be true that what somebody who comes from far away from California would think about the place as depicted in, you know, films and television and books is somewhat different than what I depict. But there is a great tradition in literature of authors who take on big and serious subjects. And although we haven't really had an author like him since, John Steinbeck was a great chronicler of the machinations of poverty in California. And he was from the Central Valley, and he wrote beautifully about it. And there was an author named, he's still alive, Leonard Gardner, who wrote Fat City, which takes place in Stockton. And then John Huston made it into a beautiful movie, is a terrific portrait of kind of small town, rough life in Central California. So there are these great precedents for authors I admire a lot who were willing to immerse themselves in the world and write about the world.
You definitely immersed yourself in this world, and you talked to many of the women. What did you hear in the stories that they told you? Was there a commonality to those stories?
Not really. And maybe I should also say that the narrator of the book is not, she's not really a synthesis of any conversations that I had with any women. She's very much a girl from my own neighborhood, you know, where I grew up, and has as her friend group, my friend group. And I needed to draw from a world that was very familiar to me in order to have the kind of depth of understanding of her that would allow me to make a believable character who's heading into prison for a very long sentence. I have relationships now, friendships with women who are serving life sentences, and that's through a human rights group that I used to work with called Justice Now. And I don't think I could summarize what those conversations are like. Each one is different. Some of them are people who are interested in writing, so I mentor them on their writing. Some of them are people who have mentored me on the tricks and methods and strategies of survival inside a prison. One of them is a woman who went to prison at the age of 15. And it's basically, although my main character has nothing in common with her aside from the sentence, I used her sentence, which is two life sentences not to be served concurrently, as it's stated in the sentencing hearing, plus a 6-year enhancement. And she's been in prison since she was 15 years old. She has a murder conviction. Something went terribly wrong. She went to a slumber party. This thing happened. Her and another friend killed an old woman. And she she was arrested that night and has never been home since. And in certain ways is a quite young person because she's never lived free since she was 15 years old. So let's say my relationship with her is more kind of big sister, little sister, and she has no family that she can call. And there are a lot of women like that in prison who have no access to people on the outside who they can just check in with. They're just alone in prison. And that's another maybe mark of difference in gender. The men have women and children who come to see them regularly and support them faithfully. And the women don't have that.
In the novel, you really don't, you know, sugarcoat the ugliness of the characters and their lives because they've had a very tough life, obviously. And they still have a tough life. How difficult was that to write, that toughness, that rawness, that ugliness?
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of what in the book is ugly. I mean, maybe to me, what's difficult might not be what seems difficult.
Difficult to you?
From the perspective of the reader. Well, and see, now I don't know. It's sort of all a blur. You know, it takes 5 years to write a book. I mean, there's one character in the book called Doc, who was a former Los Angeles police officer serving a sentence of life without possibility of parole. That means you are meant to die inside the prison. And he is sort of inspired by a guy I met when I was inside of a men's prison on their what they call sensitive needs yard, meaning a yard populated by people who would basically be killed immediately if they were put into general population. And he's there because he's a cop. People in prison don't like cops.
Oh.
And I was in his cell with him, and he started telling me how he would extrajudicially murder people on the job working for the LAPD. And in his cell surrounding him were like the little features of his very tiny life in this cell. He had a plant. He had a lizard in a box. He had two photographs of Harley Davidsons on the wall. Obviously, those aren't his motorcycles anymore. He's serving life without possibility of parole. And I was kind of overcome by this person's humanity, regardless of what he's done and the heaviness of him thinking that he can impress me by telling me about people that he's killed that he was never convicted for. I had to write about him kind of just to exorcise the experience of having taken in so much of his essence in a short amount of time in a small room. So writing him in a way was easy compared to what it was like to think about his life right after I met him and kind of reorganize my reality based on what I'd just been exposed to.
The only real softness really comes in the story from Romy's little boy, Jackson. How important was it to have a child's perspective in the story as well?
I think her having a child was something that just came to me naturally, partly because it's realistic. Most women in prison have children under 18. And then it's hard not to think about the fates and lives of those children. Most will end up incarcerated themselves, statistically. Children need so much. I'm a parent myself. I have a boy is almost 12, and kids need so much. And the idea of a child not having a mother and also being in a situation where your parental rights are terminated in a pretty bureaucratic manner, that is reality. And in California, I think they do that in the interest of the child so that they can fast track children for adoption and get them into a stable environment. But that, you know, would be really tough on a woman to have that happen to you. So I think having a child myself better equipped me to write about that. But it's just one of those instinctive things that happen when you're working on fiction. And I know people in prison who have children, and it's hard on them.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard on them. Where did the title come from?
Oh, that's a good question. Titles are hard for me.
Yeah, titles are hard for a lot of people, though.
I actually had a different working title.
What was it?
For the book. It was I Am a Destiny, which is what they're titling it in German, because it is an explicit reference to Nietzsche. In his last book, Ecce Homo, there's a chapter titled Why I Am a Destiny. And the declaration of it, the force of it, always interested me, partly because Romy Hall has really no capacity to alter her own destiny. And Nietzsche's argument is that even when beset with a destiny, you can form an active rather than a passive relationship to it and claim it as your own. But the title in English, I think, has one too many syllables. And the title is a reference to the club where she works, the Mars Room. But it never occurred to me to use it as the title for the book until the writer Don DeLillo, who is a friend of mine, he read the book and he knew that I was in desperate need of a title. And he called me and said, I would like to see this book called The Mars Room. And I thought, when Don DeLillo tells you to do something, maybe it's a good idea to listen. Yeah, so then I was with him after that in a few different environments where there were writers or other people, and they would say, oh, I heard you have a book coming out. And he would say, ask her what it's titled. Even though he's quite modest guy, I think he wanted credit for that, and I'm grateful.
You're grateful? Even though you get to go with the other title in Germany?
Well, I like Mars Room because Mars is something strange and distant and vast, and room is closed and confined, and there's some tension between those two words.
There certainly are. Rachel, you've been such a great guest. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Author Rachel Kushner has been my guest in the drawing room tonight. Her book is called The Mars Room and is available, of course, at all good bookshops.